We live in such an immoral culture. Immorality that's portrayed through the internet, through the movies, through TV, through music, through the billboards. Our kids are just being pounded by all this information. What do we as parents do about it?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband, Larry, she is employed by the Charis Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
So Jack, a lot of parents struggle with two things at different ends of the continuum. On one hand, parents really struggle with tremendous discouragement. Another end of the continuum is they struggle with pride, or they have a lot of pride. I'd like to talk about both of those today, both some of our discouragements, difficulties in being a parent, but also some of our pride in being a parent. Now, about a week ago, one of your daughters graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, us in this kind of radio room were talking about that last week, and one of the things that you failed to tell us was that your daughter, actually two of your daughters, got the highest awards for each of their classes. And I think what it was an award for all-around person, student, athlete. Your kids are kind of all-around type people. Mm-hmm. He's shaking his head yes, and he had this big sigh. So if they were my children, I would have a tendency to think what a great parent I am and have a lot of pride. I'm wondering if that's true for you, and if so, how do you deal with it? I think he's going to tell us he doesn't really know how he deals with this pride.
Okay, let's see. How do I deal with it? Oftentimes not very well. Where I see the pride is most keenly, most acutely, is when they get passed over for recognition that I think they deserve. I think outwardly I am gracious enough, but inwardly, presumably where nobody can see, it's very galling to me.
What's galling mean? Like, I can't believe that you guys passed over my kids.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know that I need to be a lot more gracious on the inside than I am about those kinds of things. So I think that's where I really see it most acutely, see where my pride is at work. This is our third child going through high school. I know how it works. I've had time to reflect on these things. The awards are not as big a deal to me now as they were with my first child.
Why is that?
Like so many things in this life, the glory that one gains in this world is a very temporary, fleeting glory. I recognize how 2 days later you don't remember who won the awards. At least I don't. maybe some people do, but I don't. I realize how political awards are, how subjective they are, how...
What do you mean, how political they are? You mean you're giving great grants to the school in order for your children to get these awards?
Oh, I don't think there's anything quite that crass, but interestingly enough, and another award that is given at our particular school is Outstanding Senior Man, Outstanding Senior Woman award. And I've just noticed over the course of three children that have gone through three assemblies that I've gone to, award assemblies I've gone to. For 2 years, the award was given to a son or daughter of another teacher in the school. Well, that's striking. I mean, that's odd. The people voting, I think, are faculty administration, and they simply get to know that child more because they're kind of a part of the social network of the school, or at least the working network in the school. So they just have more opportunity to be known. They feel more comfortable with the faculty administration. There's all kinds of factors that go into why they are noticed other than just their abilities and contributions. Not that the others are not there. I mean, lots of children are very, very talented and have a lot of abilities and make tremendous contributions. So how does one get singled out beyond the others? It's just a relatively random process. Or at least there are factors beyond what is supposedly being recognized. Well, when you begin to see all of that, then you begin to see that this is not some kind of statement about my child. It's just, these are awards, and awards mean only that in all of the various processes that are going on that lead to somebody being recognized, those processes led to this one being singled out and recognized, not the others. So I don't take it quite so seriously as I did at first. And generally over the course of my lifetime,
so at first you were pretty offended by it.
Yeah, more so. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But over the course of my whole life, I've had to deal with the question of I don't know whether our generation did this more than the younger generation coming up or not, but we had the famed identity crisis, and I struggled with my identity crisis pretty acutely when I was young. And part of what I had to come to terms with there is recognizing that one does not need to excel to be significant. One does not need to be the best to be truly significant. And I think that's a lesson that runs pretty deep in me, that I really believe. I mean, it's a real conviction of mine. And as I've watched over the years and realized how many really remarkable people there are in the world who would never be recognized or acknowledged as remarkable. Because, I think I've talked about this before, our society and our culture has such narrow criteria that it uses for honor, acknowledgement, fame, award, and so on. Maybe you could be recognized for a few dozen things, but the ways in which people are remarkable are thousands of different ways. So there are some people who are never going to be really recognized or acknowledged by our culture and our society for being outstanding people, because they don't excel, or they are not outstanding in exactly the right way to register on society's meter. So, you know, when I recognize those things, then I take awards and honors and glory less seriously.
Okay, well, let's go away from honors or rewards for a minute. What about, you've got children also that really excel in sports, in soccer in particular. You see them out there on the soccer field, they're making the goals, they're making the assists, whatever happens out there, that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Your kids are doing it. Your pride must come up about that time.
Well, pretty much the same thing as with the other honors. If someone is acknowledged somehow through praise or recognition or something above and beyond what I think would be equally due to my child, then it bothers me, it bugs me, and ultimately, I ought to be able to just graciously appreciate the fact that somebody is being acknowledged and not worry about whether my child is being acknowledged or not. I can't think of any other way that it manifests itself, but that's a constant ongoing struggle to remind myself this is not about This is not about being recognized by other people.
And how do you deal with it with your children? Do they bring it up?
No, they don't. They don't. They're probably, I think they struggle with it a lot less than I do. I mean, I don't know that it matters that much to them. If so, they keep it very much inside. They don't ever express any real lust for glory. That I think they play because they enjoy the game, not for the glory of it particularly. Although, I suppose I see little signs that they follow their own statistics and want to know how they're doing. So, in that respect, they must be registering somewhere.
Mm-hmm. You know what I notice myself doing when my children are competing, or not even necessarily when they're doing well, but I was noticing my son who was at a track meet, and there was about, there must have been 12 kids running this long race. I think it's like 3 or 4 times around the track, and the 1500. And he's running, and he's definitely not one of the athletes at the front. I mean, about the second lap around, there's kids that are a half a track ahead of him. He's about in the middle. And I just am so grateful that he has a body that can allow him to do this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think of, in fact, I was very much reminded of this at the last race, because there was a boy that was racing in a wheelchair along with the other runners. He didn't have use of his legs, and I was so proud of that boy for doing that. And I was, though, so grateful. It kind of felt like when my children were born and they came out of the womb and I checked them over. Do they have all their fingers? Do they have ears? Does it look like they're healthy? And it was that whole feeling of wonder again as I saw this incredible opportunity to be healthy.
Yeah.
So that, it was just a great experience for me. But I've had to really work at, although, like you, wanting my children to get awards, my children are not falling into those categories where they're going to get those kinds of awards usually. And so I've had to appreciate the fact that they're in the race, appreciate the fact that they're making an effort, and have come slowly over time to what I just said to you, that, oh, isn't it great that they have a healthy body? And having worked at that, I feel it really to my core.
Yeah.
But it didn't come without work.
Right.
It doesn't come without work.
Right. No, it's the identity crisis all over again. I mean, we think that we've solved all those problems with respect to ourselves. Then our children come along, and we have to relearn them all over again.
Oh, and well said.
It's a really weird thing. I don't know why that would be, but they're just that tendency to so identify with our children and want them to be that reflection of ourselves. And
well, I think what it is we haven't worked through.
We
went through it.
Yeah.
But we didn't quite work through it, and having our children go through it provides us with an opportunity
to finally
face into it.
Yeah, that could be.
Or to not. And I think, you know, we're laughing a little bit about it, but this is very important, because we can go through this identity crisis of our own through our children by getting our children to be something different than they are in order to not have to face into our own inadequacies or disappointments or whatever, to get them to do it for us. Or we can face into it and sometimes suffer along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are very, there are some parents who have children who do it all. And I was with a woman and her daughter recently, and we spent an evening together, a dinner for about 3 hours. And the dinner was all about this woman's daughter. She's very beautiful. She's very athletic. She's very bright. She's very successful. This is an adult child. She's probably about 30. She's very successful in her work. she's very wealthy. So you look at kind of those are some of the indicators that we look at, those mm-hmm. those few indicators that we look at.
Right.
And according to those meters, she has got it all plus. And this woman was the mother was just effusive about her daughter. And the daughter was very effusive about herself. And I think that's a really good example of this woman living through her daughter's successes, and the pride was just going haywire.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the mother was doing her daughter a favor at all. She had raised her to be this person that was, you know, a corsage on her,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a medal for the mother. And the daughter did it par excellence. To me, it was a really very sad situation
mm-hmm.
To have to keep up this whole outward appearance, having to be this way all the time. There was just no peace. There was no relaxing
mm-hmm.
in our interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the themes that we've had in this parenting is, hey, parents, let's look at ourselves and our contributions to our kids, both positive and negative. And I think that that is really an important one to look at also. How are we working out our own issues through our children? Are we doing it? If so, I think we need to take a second look.
Actually, just the other night, I was in a conversation with another parent on the sidelines of a soccer practice, and I said something that I, as I reflected back on it later, and asked myself, now, why on earth did you say that? And I realized it was just kind of the standard technique that we as parents always use. Basically, what I was saying is, notice my child. I mean, saying to the other parent, notice my child and acknowledge the excellence of my child.
Of course, you were doing that very subtly, so nobody would know but you.
Right.
And you
right.
didn't even know till later.
Yeah, I had to try to figure out what it was, why I even said that. But, you know, what's interesting is that it really points to the inherent problem with glory in this world. Because glory in this world is not really all that inherently significant. That's why we have to keep drawing people's attention to it and reminding them, oh, by the way, there's something there worth noticing. It's not obvious to everybody else that there's something there worth noticing. We have to draw attention to it. And the example that you gave of a mother going on and on and on with all kinds of praise for their child, that's the same strategy. I mean, that's sort of an extreme case of the same thing that I was doing. And that's one of the most important things that we learn with respect to ourselves, with respect to our children, with respect to life in this world, is that the glory of this world is fading. The glory of this world is insubstantial. It's really largely a myth, a fantasy. And I remind myself of that quite often when I start thinking about, my child did such and such. Everybody in the whole city must be noticing that. I mean, I don't know if I ever thought exactly that, but that's what it feels like. You know, it feels like, oh, wow, everybody is noticing this.
You're really and, so at the top of the world.
Right. And then what brings me back to reality is to remind myself, you know what? 99.9% of the people in the whole city didn't even notice that she did that. And they could care less. They don't even like the game. They don't even follow the game. I mean, if it's in sports. And most of the people... So, largely, this euphoria that we feel is largely just completely self-induced and a fiction, a bubble, a fantasy that has no substance to it and no reality to it at all. And that helps a lot when I can get perspective on it. Is, did they achieve? Yes. Did they achieve anything that's really all that substantial? No, not really. Nothing that's lasting, nothing that in the end really matters. It's just a stupid game. Now, I say that on the one hand. On the other hand, there are those pure moments where I just literally marvel at what they have learned to do with their legs and their feet. And just the sheer art of it is really astounding to me sometimes. And there are those moments when it's just the pure enjoyment of the ability itself and the skill itself, and I admire that in other players as well as my own children. So there are those pure moments. It's not nothing. It is something that the human body has learned to do and is really remarkable. But from the standpoint of eternity, it is utterly nothing. It is utterly insubstantial. And it's when I can keep that perspective. The one thing that I hope I have said to them, I know I have not said it enough, but I believe I've communicated this to them, is when they're really feeling good about what they've accomplished athletically, is to try to remind them, the thing that I really want is for you to be a person of character. I want integrity. I'd like to see you, as the Bible puts it, hunger and thirst after righteousness. As remarkable an achievement as this is, it really doesn't measure up at all to being a person who's humble and kind and compassionate and gracious and a person of integrity.
And sometimes that can be more difficult. Certainly the Bible says the rich man has a much more difficult time entering into the kingdom. And so a rich man can be someone with money, or a rich man can be someone with athletic or other abilities.
Right, right.
And so from that perspective, it gets a little scary. Are they looking at what's important? Lots of times the awards that children get don't really do point out the effort of a child. But lots of times the child that doesn't get the award also has put in maybe the equal amount of effort. And the question that I ask my children, very similar to yours, is what was important about what you did here? And I ask myself that. Are they kids that are becoming kind? Do they want to look out for the interest of both themselves and other people? Those are the things that last. There's a lot that doesn't last. The gold medal tarnishes, the ribbon, the acknowledgement goes away. But what have they learned through the activity is something that's really important to ask. And I think for parents who don't have kids that are excelling in these particular ways, that's the focus that we all really need to have. Actually, all of us need to have that same focus.
Right.
Okay. I know early on that I wanted my children to really achieve and to, you know, in the sense of where it would be seen. And like I said before, it's taken some time for me to get to the place where I want something other than just their achievement. And I think their achievement, I mean, just their awards and, you know, being seen. And I think it was mostly about my own pride and my own desire to look special, to have some kind of prestige, rather than it being about them. So, Jack, let's do a little bit of a switch here. And there's lots of areas that parents have to face into as their children are growing up, particularly with young children, and that are kind of difficult to face into. So there's this whole category of things out there, that messages that might attract our children. Movies, TV, Nintendo, music, sexuality, friends, things outside the home that are attractive to our children. Let's talk a little bit about what do we do in each of those areas with our children.
Okay. Which first?
Well, you know, I'm looking at these areas, and I want to add another one, and that's violence. That's portrayed through the movies, through TV, through Nintendo, through music. So it seems like two of the threads that run through each of those things are violence and sexuality. And I think I'd like to start with sexuality. We have talked about sexuality in the past here, but how do we teach our children about sexuality with all these outside influences, bringing them in a direction that's actually quite immoral most of the time?
Yeah, we live in a terrible age in that regard. I look back on my childhood and compare that with my children's environment, and I could long for the day when I was growing up, so if they could only have that environment. You know, I managed to grow up without, I don't think, I was in college before, maybe I'm forgetting, but I think it's true that I was in college before I had seen a picture of a naked woman. And that's just how protected I was. That's just how isolated I was. Now, I was probably very unusual in my generation, but...
You know, what flashed through my mind when you said that was, I don't think I saw a picture of a naked man. Well, maybe. Stole a book out of one of my parents' books on sexuality or something, but mm-hmm. that was just like a pencil
a
diagram.
Drawing or something,
a drawing, yeah. I remember going... on a 3-month trip to Europe, and we were looking at statues in some museum, and there was a statue by some famous artist of a man, and I remember stopping and studying it. Mm. I was in college too.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Right. And yet our children are just subjected to all kinds of images on nightly television even. And I just cringe. One way to go would be to try to isolate ourselves from our culture. We have not done that altogether with our family, although we censor the things that on television and movies that our children watch as best we can. But the problem is it's so pervasive that, I mean, even the ad coming on for the movie that night, that you're totally unaware of, is showing scenes that I'd rather they didn't see.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have been so discouraged about how in the world to pay attention to what my kids see on the TV. We don't let them see a lot of TV. That's part of it.
Yeah.
But I'm appalled by what's on TV.
No, it's terrible.
Maybe I'm a prude, but I hate it. And there's really, if we're going to allow them to turn on the TV, we've got to expect that those images will be there.
Right.
Not even the ads about the upcoming show, but the ads...
Commercials.
...about cigarettes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So we live in a very, very sexualized culture, a very sensual culture, and, I mean, even if we threw out our TV, there's billboards, and you just can't live in this society and not be bombarded by images that you and I were relatively protected from.
And even auditory images, Jack.
Yeah,
music.
Oh, yeah.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. So we live in really lousy times with respect to growing up sexually, I think, and our children are really at a tremendous disadvantage. All I have known to do to try to counteract that is to teach them, talk to them about what I think the biblical view of sexuality is, and it's all the content of the material that we talked about in an earlier series on this program. It's that content that I've tried to convey to them. Now, my older two children kind of naturally, I think they're like me in that regard, they kind of naturally stepped outside the circle. They're what I would call watchers. They were not a part of the social whirl of their school life, and so they did not really have a social life. They watched the other people have their social lives and learned from it. And the problem, of course, is the problem that they're going to have to struggle with is self-righteousness and contempt as they look in at the superficiality and the game playing and the all the garbage that's going on there, and they're above all that. Well, ultimately, they're not above all that, and they're going to have to find out, and they're going to have to learn that, and they're going to have to deal with the temptation toward contempt and self-righteousness. But at least I understand them. You know, I understand.
Because that was what you did.
Because that's what I did. My younger two are right in the thick of the social whirl, and I'm just at sea. I don't know how to help them. I don't know what temptations they face exactly. I don't know what draws them to that. I don't know how to warn them, really. So, you know, I really feel helpless. I don't know. I'm just kind of holding my breath and hoping I have the right things to say and hope I make the right choices and set the right boundaries. And
Now, you say you feel helpless. I'm not sure that's what you're describing. It's like you don't have as much feeling of control as you did with the older two.
Yeah,
you have a sense
of
the direction they're going to go. They were going in. You have not helplessness in the sense that you don't have anything to say. You have a lot to say, but you don't have a very good measure on where you think this is going to take them.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't have any confidence that I'm doing it right.
I think you're feeling out of control, Jack.
Yes, I am. Very much so.
Yeah, it's a scary feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you do with it?
Well, ultimately I recognize it's not up to me to be in control. I mean, that, as I've said earlier, they are not primarily mine, they are God's. And God knows what little packages he created there, and he's ordaining their entire experience and environment. And I need to try to be responsible in my role as a parent, but I can't guarantee the outcome. I never could guarantee the outcome. I can't even guarantee the outcome with my older children, where I felt more confident. But there's no guarantees there either. They're ultimately in God's hands, and I just need to trust God that he's going to see them through it. He may see them through it in a way that I would have not preferred. They may make a lot of mistakes. So outwardly, they may fail in ways that will be really extremely disappointing to me. But again, I have to be prepared to accept that, because that's God's providence. That's the hand of God. God's sovereignly writing the script for their lives. And I have no right to step in and forbid that he do that. So there's some rest that I can get there when I recognize that all you can do is your best, Jack, and try to be your wisest. But from then on, they're in God's hands.
But if I'm hearing you right, you're having to remind yourself of that a lot, because
yeah.
It doesn't feel comfortable at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And it would be easy to try and legislate far more than we should. I've found, for example, that I've done a lot of teaching about sexuality with my kids, in the sense of looking at the underlying values, why I have the values that I do, why I have the opinions that I do, why I have the structure that I do. And, you know, my kids just they don't get it. Sometimes they don't really think it's very valid, or at least they try and tell me that. There's come a point now, as my children have gotten older, that I need just to shut up. And that's been a really hard thing for me. They've heard my story. They heard me say it over and over again. I think maybe the last time I said it, my oldest son said, "Mom, stop. We could tell you it." So they know the words. They understand. I mean, they know the words. They've got to take it where they take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that letting go is a very difficult task of a parent.
Yeah.
To have infused them with as much information, as many values as we possibly can. And then we have to just say, okay. And I think that's where you're going now, is they're yours, God, ultimately. And I've done the best job I can. I'm continuing to do the best job I can. But maybe now the job that I'm doing needs just to be back off, be quiet, be available.
Mm-hmm.
Always be very available. It's a very active availability, a very active backing off. But it's a definite move out, don't invade in their life. Let them live their own life, let them make their own choices, and hope that what we've infused in them comes to life.
I'm struggling with that with one of my children here. I'm available, and this child is not availing him or herself to my availability. And so it's very tempting to want to make my availability more known.
So how do you make it more known, Jack? What are the little deceptive things that you find yourself doing?
Well, I think I'm not, because the child is so unreceptive to it that it's not even worth trying. But it's me.
You get a
my
back
struggle.
Off dad all the time.
Yeah, my struggle is just emotionally the rejection, the helplessness of how can you help someone who doesn't want to be helped? What do you do with that? Because you you know, the parent in me very much wants to help, and I know that I could help, but not interested, apparently, anyway. So I just have to wait.
Yeah, that's a really good example of backing off, shutting up, and being actively available. And having, as we said in the past, having to really suffer with what is not happening with our children that we would really like to be happening. Just instead of trying to push them in the direction that would make us more comfortable, not do that. Allow them to go in the direction that they're going to go in. If we push them in a direction, what we're going to end up with is kids that learn how to be very good hypocrites that can cover up what's really going on, or kids that can be very rebellious, and we give them something to resist and they will take us on, and it becomes a major power struggle. So it really doesn't work anyway.
Right, right.
So the best thing that actually is most loving and helps them develop their own selves and for us to develop our own selves is to shut up and suffer with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very difficult choice to come to. You know, there's another media that we haven't talked about, and that's the internet, kind of the newest one, where there is such a huge availability of pornography, and it's right at the fingertips of our children. And even if we have the internet turned off, or somehow there's, I know in our family there's a way to not make that available to the children, but they have their friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's
school, library.
School. I mean, it's everywhere. And I think that the bottom line is that there is so much available to our kids that there's no way we can stop it. And that's kind of where I've come to, is I cannot go around and police my children's life to the extent that I would need to in order for them not to be involved in making poor choices. And I am hoping that it is the teaching that we've given them might pay off, but it may not pay off until after they've made a lot of bad choices. I don't necessarily see that with my children much right now, but I don't think I see as much as I need to see. They're not making it available to me because they cannot be as unscathed by all that's available to them as they make it look to me. I know that there's stuff that must be going on that I never see. I never know. They could be getting up in the middle of the night and watching things that I have no clue about. So we really are at the mercy of God to teach them actually through this horrible influence in our society. And it just makes a lot of sense to me that that's a tool God's going to use in our children's lives.
And given the onslaught of pornography and images and sensuality and everything in our culture, the strategy of trying to isolate ourselves from it just seems to me utterly futile, and far more important to put our energy into teaching our children self-censorship, because that's the ideal antidote, is that if I can learn to decide to not permit myself to watch certain things or go certain places or see certain things, then it doesn't matter what society is doing. I shut it out myself. If I can teach my children self-censorship, then great. Now, how do you do that? I don't know.
I think the only way that you do that is the children come to have the values that they really don't want those things in their life.
Right, right.
And it might be through a lot of failure that they end up finding out, I really don't want that in my life. It's not worth the price that I've had to pay here. And then the children may come to their own self-censorship. But I don't think it's by a rule that they can really come to that. It's through developing their internal sense of what's important to them, what's valuable to them, and then living by that. This brings to mind a question that lots of parents ask me. They come in and say, okay, my child has failed. They might find their kids having been involved with drugs or been involved with some kind of sexuality, some kind of perversion in some way, some kind of immorality. And it's very attractive to the child. The parents are saying, what do we do now? How do we deal with the fact that we found that our child is smoking pot? I think the worst thing we could do, Jack, is we could make is to make that child feel like a despicable human being. And that happens so often. And I don't know a lot about what to say right now because individuals are situations are so individual. But I can say that one thing across the board is we need not to act like when we find somebody in sin that they're somehow different or worse than us. And that is absolutely horrible. I think it's as bad, certainly, as the act that our child has been involved in. To shame our child, to make them feel like they're awful, less than, dirty, bad human beings, that how could they possibly think about doing something that awful? Well, that's the worst way we could handle it. We need to, on one hand, be clear that it's wrong, and be clear that we are like our children, even though we may not have sinned in the same area, and that we are supporting them, wanting to care about them, wanting to help them with this, not shaming them so they'll stop. That's a terrible thing to do it to a child, or do to an adult.
Yeah, if we can't empathize with them and recognize that I could be doing the same thing that they're doing, I could see myself doing that, then I would argue we really don't understand ourselves very well. And that, I agree, that's absolutely crucial, to be able to be merciful toward the mistake that they've made. And the ground for being merciful is my empathy, my recognition that I could be there. And that's what we need to communicate to them, is that, yeah, I understand. I know how I could be here. Here's why I have not chosen to go that direction. And here's why I would prefer that you not choose to go that direction. Here are the values that are important. And here's the payoff of these values, and here's why this is. Here's why the road that you're on is self-destructive, and you'd be much better off on another road. But do that from the standpoint not of scolding them for being so
despicable.
So despicable, but empathetically recognizing how attractive that other road can be, but how ultimately self-destructive it is.
I think another thing that we can do, Jack, is that we, like I've said in a previous program also, that we need to look at the behavior as maybe having some information that can be made available to us. Why is my child involved in this? Is there something that this behavior is a message that it can give me about my child? Can I learn something through this whole situation? Might it open up some dialogue between us? Might my child be saying, I'm so starved for affection, perhaps, that I'm looking at pornography or involved in a sexual relationship with my young girlfriend or boyfriend? Do I need to look at how can I nurture them better through this? But giving ourselves the opportunity not just to learn from this and what we can do as to better be parents, as well as we were just saying, trying to instruct our kids with mercy. I think where parents first go is, how do I just get them to stop? How do I just make legislate their behavior? Sometimes there's some immediate action that needs to be taken because there is some danger or health problems or some kind of danger involved, and they need some help to put some brakes on. But as we're doing that, we need to keep the other things very high on our priority list. What we want to do as parents is just stop it, just make it go away. And I think we lose the opportunity for a connectedness between us through a dialogue that can go on through learning about ourselves and about our children and about our own parenting. That needs to be primary for us. And if we find ourselves, kind of going back to what we were saying before, shaming our children and making them despicable, then we have a lot of looking at how can I grow up ourselves. It is kind of a measure of my own maturity whether or not I can accept that kind of behavior in other people. I think if we're looking for signs of maturity, it's when somebody comes to me having sinned, do I see them with contempt or do I see them with compassion?
Just so we are clear here, you're not suggesting, I believe, that some of this behavior is not shameful.
No, right? But it is wrong.
Yeah.
It is immoral.
Right.
It is hurtful.
And ultimately, from a certain point of view, really all of us behave in ways that is truly objectively despicable. It's not that it's not that, but what you're objecting to is not the evaluation of behavior as despicable, but as the distance between me, who is not despicable, and you.
It's the way I deal with it with the other person.
Yeah.
It's how I treat them.
It's my self-righteousness that's the ultimate problem. My contempt, my self-righteousness, my communicating that you are below me. Because that's absolutely the worst message we can give any other human being. They know that it's shameful. They know that it's despicable. They don't really need to be told that. They may not acknowledge it or admit it. But all of us know that our shameful behavior is shameful at some level. And when we send the message that there must be something wrong with you that's not wrong with me and the rest of humanity, then we're distorting reality for them, or we're attempting to. I mean, our words and our actions are tending to give them a distorted view of reality, namely that they are somehow irredeemable in a way that we're not. And that is just false. That's a lie. And that is a very dangerous and damaging lie. So it's very important that we put ourselves there with them. We are broken, but we are all broken. We are foolish, but we are all foolish. We are contemptible, but we are all contemptible. And what are we going to do with the fact that we're all contemptible? Well, that's where the gospel is a very, very important message of good news, is that God has provided a way to give us what we don't deserve anyway, eternal life.
Now, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said, well, if I do these things, is God mad at me then? I feel so bad, so wrong. Is God against me when I do these things? What would your answer to that person be?
I suppose my long answer would be yes, those are the sorts of things that make God angry, but that's what Jesus is all about. He's the propitiation of God's anger. And then I would explain what propitiation is.
I would sure hope so, Jack.
God is a wrathful God against unrighteousness and against our foolishness and against the darkness of our hearts and the deceit of our hearts. He is angry at that, but he has opted to be merciful. And the whole role of Jesus was to come and appeal to God with this very costly offering that he gave, namely his own life, to appeal to God for mercy. And the promise of God in the gospel is that he will look upon all of my despicable acts with mercy. He's going to forgive them and not hold them against us.
My short answer to this person was, just the last part was, well, God hung on the cross because he expected that you were going to be doing these kinds of things. It's no surprise to him.
Right, that's good, yeah.
And there is utter forgiveness. And the time you spend on only cutting yourself down and feeling excessively guilty is just keeping you from recognizing reality, which is that we are forgiven.
Forgiven, that's true.
And that's what we need to communicate to our children. We need to be forgiving, and we need to be merciful. And we need to be forgiving, and we need to be merciful over and over and over again.
Because that's how God deals with us.
That's how God deals with us.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
We do continue to receive letters from you, our listeners, and we keep on telling you, thank you for your letters. But I want to say that I don't think we've received enough letters. It is really important to us to know the impact of our ministry, what it is that's helpful to you, and what it is that's not helpful to you. Recently, Jack received a letter from somebody who is very concerned about the monthly letter that we send out, and really disagreed with Jack, and followed that letter up here very recently, and said this, and I'd like to read the letter because I really think it is the mark of a Christian who's willing to see themselves and honestly confront what's going on in their lives and in their thoughts and in their actions. And this is really an example of that. She begins by saying, I want to ask your forgiveness for trying to fix you in the letter I wrote on March 16th. It was in response to your March letter to supporters of Christianity at Work. And I'm going to skip down some. She says, I know I must face my fears or die of them. This doesn't mean that I strike out against anyone physically. It just means I need to get in touch with the real Jesus, not the one of my dreams. And I think that's very much what we're trying to do here. Is I think lots of times we have this idea of we want Jesus to be in our life, and that's not it at all. We have to face into the reality of who Jesus is. That takes a lot of courage, and I really appreciate the courage of this person to recognize when they were wrong and be willing to ask for forgiveness. And she says, please forgive me for trying to squelch your freedom of speech. I'm sorry for the pain I shoved your way. I know that concerning pagans of history being morally better than many present born-again Christians, I have much to learn. I'm sure I can stand to grow in evidencing an authentic and substantial commitment to godliness in all its forms, too. So, pretty great letter.
Yeah, it is. And I want to reassure her that I did not in any way take offense at her initial letter. It was very respectful and very kind, actually. But I think it's great that she has the kind of courage to evaluate herself, to evaluate her ideas, and to learn new things and to come to new perspectives. That's very commendable.
I underline that so many times, and I guess if there's anything that we would like more than anything else, is that not that people have more information in their heads, but it works itself out in their lives, and I think very much it's working itself out in her life.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. 4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.